Hey, it's John Harris, and I just got my True Diagnostics True Age test results, and boy, was I surprised. I found out my biological age is 0.36% of a year younger than my actual age. This is good because if my biological age were 5 years more than my true age, my risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease could jump by as much as 30 to 50%. Here's a kicker. 90% of aging is in my control through lifestyle and habits. It was so easy. A quick at-home finger prick, send it off, and in 2 to 3 weeks, I got a detailed report. The test showed that my heart and lungs are in good shape, but I could use some extra support for my immune system. It gave me tailored clips from Harvard and Yale scientists, like tweaking my diet and sleep, to slow aging and cut risks. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to TrueDiagnostic.com and use my code Harris to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use HARRIS at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
60% of people will avoid your business if you have an unattractive logo. This podcast is sponsored by Resurrection Design Company, which helps kingdom-minded businesses and churches fix that problem. Right now, they're running a special for the listeners of this podcast, a free website design for the first 2 people who sign up for a brand identity package. This offer expires the last day of this month, so get out your phone now and visit resurrectiondesign.co/matter to claim your free website design. The link is in the description.
Welcome once again to the Conversations That Matter podcast. I'm your host, John Harris. We have a very special guest today, someone who I really appreciate has influenced me in many ways. In fact, it was in 2017 at an Abbeville Institute summer school that I first heard about the term ideology used in the way we're going to be talking about it today. And that was from Dr. Don Livingston. He is a professor, former professor at Emory University. I should probably ask you first, Dr. Livingston, are you the former president or current president of Abbeville Institute?
Well, I founded it and I was the president for 20 years.
So you're the
Mike
founder.
Houlihan is now doing a splendid job as president, and I help with the, you know, with the publishing part. We publish books.
Right. Okay. So I got that wrong, but you are the founder of the Abbeville Institute. And in 2017 at the summer conference, you were the president at that point, and you gave a great talk on ideology. And anything else you want us to know about you, where people can find you and your books that you're publishing or support Abbeville or anything else?
Well, no, I think that's all. You know, one cannot talk about oneself long without being vain. So let's just skip it.
Okay. Well, you are a professor of philosophy and you've written a great book on that subject. I know that that will probably factor into some of our discussion today. So maybe we should just get started and talk about what ideology is in comparison to something like tradition. Conservatives talk about tradition. Ideology is different than that. But I've had people tell me, oh, everyone has an ideology. Isn't that just inescapable? People just have a way of thinking about things.
Well, ideology, like so many terms we use, freedom, democracy, can be used in many, many different ways. So there's no innocent use of democracy or liberty or freedom or slavery or any of these morally and socially charged ideas. That's the first thing. So we have to stipulate what we mean by ideology and give a reason why that is a plausible meaning. Ideology is a disease of the intellect. The diseases of the body, cancer, a bacterial infection. They're diseases of inquiry. There's a difference between scientific inquiry and black magic or astrology. Both of these are inquiries into the nature of how the world works. But some of these inquiries are pathological. They do not get results, and they somehow corrupt. They corrupt the souls of those who employ them. Astrology not only isn't true, it corrupts those who employ it. They are inclined to believe things that are not true and things that can be destructive of their conduct. So, but ideology is a disease of the intellect. I might also mention psychology, which is a disease of the passions, a disorder of the imagination, a disorder of the passions. It's also a disorder of the intellect, but because there are causes driving the intellect to disorder. But the disease that is ideology, that is a disease of the intellect, is based on reason. All ideologies claim to be based on something called reason. We might think of, so then if the ideologies are based on reason, how can they be a problem? They can be a problem only if reason itself can be a problem. Suppose there's such a thing as a true understanding of reason and a corrupt understanding of reason, such that it's hard to tell the difference. And that is the case. It's not just a supposition. Ideology is a corrupt form of rationality. It looks like rational activity, but it's really not. You might compare it to the immune system. A disease of the immune system is one in which the immune system, which is designed to protect the body, gets disordered and attacks. It's designed to protect the body. If you have immunity, the disease can't get through. It's rejected by the immune system. But the immune system can get off track and attack the body itself. It has great energy, it's insistent, it's trying to get things right, but it's directed at the wrong thing. It's directed at the body, not the bacteria or the virus. And so it corrupts the body. So ideology is the use of reason with scare quotes. That attacks the intellect in an unhealthy way.
I'm sorry to cut you off. I just wanted to clarify what you already said, that there's a corruption going on there. So there's a good way of thinking, a bad way of thinking, essentially, and ideology is the bad kind. That's I think how what we've come to so far.
Yes, but see, there's good thinking and logic, valid arguments and invalid arguments. If you think in valid terms, you can't guarantee truth from premises to conclusion. So there's a disorder of logic. There's a disorder of science. Scientific inquiry can get results. It's not infallible. It can get results. But astrology and alchemy and these other things are Alice in Wonderland, trying to understand the world. It's never going to go anywhere. And it's lasted for centuries until human beings sort of sorted out the difference between a genuine scientific inquiry and an alchemical or astrological inquiry. So it's not just that the ideology is a wrong kind of inquiry, but all sorts of wrong kinds of inquiry. It's a peculiar kind of inquiry. It's hard to detect because it's based on reason. How can reason go astray? Mm-hmm. It can go astray in the same way the immune system can go astray. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to protect the body, but it attacks the body. So so ideology uses, quote, reason to attack the body. So the question we have to ask is, well, what is reason? And how do you know the difference between reason properly understood and reason improperly understood? If we know that difference, then we can begin to understand what ideology is. It's an inappropriate, use of reason, such that it's not reason at all, but looks like it. So what we need to do then is distinguish between reason and tradition. All ideologies are opposed to tradition. And you hear people say, well, just because it's the tradition is no reason to do it. In other words, this means there's some other kind of thinking other than tradition through which we can reason. And in fact, that's better. It's better. Why is it better? It's better because reason is something you inherited. You don't know when you got it. It's a practice, a set of practices you learn from childhood on. You had no say in what you would learn, what English, what language you would speak. You just were cast into a world of English-speaking people or French-speaking people, and you learned the practices and got pretty good at it. But you had no say in it. So tradition is thoughtless in a way. In other words, you just inherit it. You learn the practices. You can reason within it. You can criticize English speakers. Some English speaking is ungrammatical and kind of hard to understand. It's not good English, and this is bad English. So we have rational criticism within English, right? But it's all based on tradition. How do you know this is good English?
Right. Yeah, right. There's not a platonic form of good English.
Now, you can't step outside the English-speaking world to determine what's good English or bad English. You're a participant in the English language, and these norms are there, and you can use them, but they are inherited. So you can see how some people would say, no, wait a minute, that's okay with English, but with science, it's different. Science steps outside of all language, and it's free of tradition, absolutely free of tradition. And it is that's what the Enlightenment argued. Enlightenment argued that we can agree on sense data. We can all agree, and we can use sense data, make predictions about the world, and agree on what's true and false, and we can change the world through scientific reason. And if scientific reason could get control of politics and economics, it could make the world a better place. It could dispense with tradition, which is made up of old wives' tales, of things you've inherited, of prejudices and customs, and God knows what. In fact, you can't even know all the things that are built into the traditions you've inherited, because they're received preconsciously, and you're not even aware of them. They can be brought to awareness here and there, but not the totality. Okay, so that's the difference. So any questions about that? I mean, tradition is?
Well, I think...
You can see why you would want to be ideological. You would want ideas that are not tainted by the particularities, prejudices, time-bound practices of tradition. Wouldn't it be nice if we could be free of that, think in a neutral, abstract, universal way, then go and change the world and according to these pure, neutral principles? That's the idea.
Right, right.
And one thing, that's what we mean by modernity. It was modern people who began to push that in the 17th century, Descartes being a famous example.
Yeah, and there's several questions. I think we could go down different veins. One of them would be, there are different traditions, though. How do you adjudicate between traditions? Religion, for example, you are a convert to Eastern Orthodoxy later in life, as I understand it. I am a Protestant. I'm like a Baptistic Protestant, right? So we have different traditions that disagree on certain points.
Right.
And this is obviously the basis for debates, discussions, and that kind of thing. But we both of us would disagree with a Muslim, and all three of us would be saying we have a tradition we're appealing to, right? So tradition can be incorrect, or there can be incorrect aspects of tradition, right?
Yes. And then the question is, well, how do you get to that? But before we go to that question, in other words, how do you choose between different traditions, or how can you even know that one could be correct? How could you even know that without stepping outside the tradition? As long as you're in it, it's going to seem reasonable. Mm-hmm. You step outside, maybe you can see that it's not reasonable. That's the point of ideology. The Enlightenment is the best example of modern ideology. And the Enlightenment, Enlightenment meant that you had stepped out of tradition. You were enlightened. You were not captured by prejudices and traditions and so on. You were free of all that. So let's look at that for a moment. Let's take something that's really rational, the metric system. We have the English system, which is based on pounds and miles and a foot and a yard is 3 feet, 36 inches, and so on. And these may have begun, a yard might have been the length from the nose to the tip of the fingers of the king, and that would be a yard. So all of this seems arbitrary. Why do we have these clumsy systems of measurement? The metric system is very clean. Everything is divisible by 10. So a meter is 100 centimeters. And you can measure the length of anything in the universe with the metric system. And so on with grams and kilograms and so on. So you look at a schedule of the metric system, you can get it on a sheet of paper. It lays out all the definitions of what a gram is and a meter and so on. And there's no tradition in it. So here we have a perfect example of ideas that are rational that we can use to apply to the world and understand it correctly, get the measurements right, the weights right. What we forget, though, is that the metric system cannot tell you how long a meter is. A meter could be this long or that long or longer. And that seems to be arbitrary. And the metric system doesn't tell you. But there's got to be a length to the standard meter. Once you know that, you can put a stick up and put a notch at each end, and you've got a meter stick you can use to measure things by. So the question is, where do we get the idea of the length? Well, in fact, in 1793, the metric system was invented in the French Revolution. And there was then an iridium bar, a metal that doesn't move much, so it's pretty stable, in a glass case, and that's the standard meter. You go up to it, measure a stick by it with notches on either end, and you've got a meter stick. Where did this come from? Well, it was authorized by the French government. It was a revolutionary government. It overthrew all measurement systems in France, all of them, and instituted this measurement system. Was that a rational act? Was the length of the standard meter based on reason? It was based on the arbitrary work of the French Revolutionary government. And Napoleon pushed it throughout Europe. And it became the system of measurement throughout Europe. It's a good system of measurement. There's no question that with the decimal system, you can measure a lot quicker than you can with the English system. I remember I had a job one time at a shop, and I was supposed to measure things by yards. So people would come in and buy, two and two-thirds yard. It was a mess to try to figure it out, at least for me. So the metric system is superior, and this is why scientists caught on to it immediately, and so did the military. So those are universally accepted, but not for everybody else. I don't want to use the metric system. I still, to this very day, cannot figure out kilograms, gram, and all that sort of thing. I want to use ounces and pounds. It works for daily life quite well for those who've inherited it. Nothing wrong with it. It's a pretty good system, but not for other practices, not for science, and not for the military. But my point is, the metric system is based on what we might call an arbitrary choice based backed by a revolutionary government.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it came from. So if you reject tradition, you're going to have to accept something like that. It's going to be backed up by force of some kind, political force, whereas tradition permeates gradually over time. Natural languages are not based on reason. People just begin speaking Chinese as children, or Indonesian languages, or Egyptian, or whatever. They speak these languages. They grow up like the air they breathe. They're normal to them.
It's organic.
And they can describe the world. They can describe physics and everything through the Chinese language. It's difficult. The Chinese had difficult because they don't have tenses and so on, but they worked it out. So have the Russians, so have the Slavic peoples and so on. Okay, so what the metric example is supposed to show us is this. You can have abstract ideas, but they have to be interpreted in terms of concrete practices in life, particular practices, not universal things, but particulars. The metric system was founded in 1793. It's an iridian bar in a particular glass case in a particular building in France, authorized by a particular revolution. That's what it is. That's what the standard is. And if you don't have that standard, you can't measure anything with the metric link. So this is true of all ideas. All men are created equal. Declaration of Independence says we hold these truths to be self-evident. In other words, we're out of tradition now. All men know, it's self-evident that all men are created equal. Sounds amazing. And we all believe it. I think most of us believe it. Somehow all men are created equal. But that's an abstraction. If we ask, in what respect are they equal? Then we begin to run into problems. Christians hold that all men are created equal because they are created in the image of God. Well, that's a lot to swallow, right? I mean, everybody's going to swallow that. What God are we talking about? The God of the Bible, a particular book with a particular notion of God. And that's why all men are created equal. All right, mm-hmm. What does Thomas Hobbes say? He says all men are equal because they have the equal power to kill each other. Human beings constantly are in a state of anarchy, naturally. If you don't have government to control them, everybody's gonna go do what they wanna do. And so they are all equally capable of killing each other. Even a 12-year-old can kill its parents. In their sleep. So since we're all equal in that respect, and this is important, there has to be some respect in which we're equal. Otherwise, equality is an empty notion, means nothing. If Hobbes is right, that all men are created equal in that respect, they're just natural beings, then we need government to somehow control that. So then you can get a theory of government out of this, in which you have to have a sovereign leader who has the power to control these willful human beings. And this means you're going to have total power in the government, total power over everybody in order to keep them civil. And that gives us a whole theory of government. Well, that's going to be quite different from Christian equality. So we have Hobbesian equality, modern Hobbesian equality, which the modern state's built on that. It presumes human beings cannot resolve their conflicts without violence. So we need to have power located somewhere in the state to be able to enforce that on everybody. So enforce civility on everybody, and the government will define what civility is. That's the modern state. Well, the Christian view is quite different. This notion of equality is quite different. And we can go to others. John Stuart Mill's and Bentham said, we're equal in respect that we suffer pain and pleasure. Let's get down to real the bottom line. We all suffer pain and pleasure. So let's build morality on something we can all agree on. We all like pleasure and we don't like pain. So we just rig the rules in such a way to maximize pleasure and minimize pain. And morality is a matter of doing that rationally. But now we have a third notion of equality. We can go on and on with this. So feminists hold that, radical feminism holds that society is inegalitarian and oppressive, and a true, correct society would be one in which there are no sexual differences. Because those are irrational, they're just particular things. What we need is universal freedom. There is no end to the notions of what equality means. So whenever you say all men are created equal, pause and ask yourself, what do you mean? And the person you're talking to, how are they going to interpret that? What do they mean? Well, if you're talking to Hobbes, you're a Christian talking to Hobbes, he's going to be thinking something quite different. And yet all of us can agree on a political party that says all men are created equal. We'd all agree. Yeah, I sign on to that. But what are the leaders of that party? What do they mean? What are they going to do with this equality, you see? And you don't know, necessarily. So ideology is cheap. You can have a very simple abstract idea, that all men are created equal, or the metric system can measure any kind of length, et cetera, but you've got to read the fine print. The fine print is what, and this is what I want to get to. I don't want to get lost in the weeds. What I want to get to is that the abstract ideas we use, there's nothing wrong with abstract ideas. The abstract ideas we use are empty. They're vacuous. They can mean most anything until you give them some content. And that content always comes from tradition, practices. One more example. Let's say equal pay for equal work. Sounds good. What's wrong with that? Well, but if a factory is making shoes, so many shoes per hour on a machine or something, and it's in Manhattan, the wages are going to be higher than they are in Mississippi for the same, exactly the same work. Same company, but the wages are different. So that's a violation of equality. So the wages should be raised in Mississippi and lowered in Manhattan for the company to be acting justly. That's what the abstract principle tells us, equal pay for equal work. No nonsense about it. But then someone says, now, wait a minute, the cost of living is higher in Manhattan than it is in Mississippi. Well, what does that have to do with it? Is that in the principle?
Right, right.
No, it's not in the principle. The principle is clear, rational, universal, necessary, cannot be denied. Equal pay for equal work. But it doesn't tell us anything, does it? About how to deal with wage differences in Mississippi and Manhattan, not to mention Colombia or Bolivia or some other country where the same company is operating. Or take abortion. All men are created equal, or unborn human beings. Create equal?
Mm-hmm.
For feminists, you could argue as follows. A feminist can argue as follows. Abortion is a violation of a woman's right to privacy. She has possession of the parts of her body which are being intruded into, and therefore, it's a violation of her natural rights. On the other hand, if you kill the individual who has who is a human being, the infant, that infant loses his right to life. So everybody believes there's a right to life, liberty, and property. The woman has property in her body. She has the right to liberty, and she has the right to happiness. Abortion violates all of those, a rule against abortion violates all of those natural rights, God-given natural rights. Now, you can make that argument. But if you switch all of a sudden and think the individual, the baby has a right to life, then the baby loses its right to life. What I'm trying to show you is that rational enlightenment morality, though it's made up of abstract principles that are universal, self-evident, we could even say abstractly true, but when you begin to apply them to the world, you run into practices of all kinds, embedded in tradition, and they all come from tradition, which is pre-reflective. And that's where all the hard work is done. So what you mean by the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness is going to be wildly different from someone who comes from a different tradition.
So there's limitations, is what I'm hearing. There's these...
Go ahead.
Sorry. Okay. I was just saying, to cap what we just talked about, there are these limitations that exist in rational inquiry that we expect, I assume if we are living in the modern world, we assume that these will take care of our problems and answer questions that we need answered and provide the universal key to understanding human life. But in reality, they themselves are vacuous. They don't hold the key that we assume they hold. And so when you get revolutionary movements based on these abstract ideals and they come into a society, there's going to end up being someone, whether a dictator or a body of people who control that society, they end up forcing their own way of living, their own, I guess, ideas that come from traditions or they're ideas that are somewhat innovative in themselves on society, and they foist it and hold it together by force instead of and whatever consequences happen based on that will just happen. There's no I think, what was it, Stalin who said something like, you have to break a few eggs. It doesn't really matter if there's consequences to forcing these things. What matters is the ideology being reflected in public life. And
yes, and that's all done in the name of truth, reason, and justice.
Right.
The communists talked about nothing but truth, reason, and justice. Liberals talk about truth, reason, and justice. And yet the United States has, the CIA has run about according to Jeffrey Sachs of Columbia University, about over 100 regime change operations. I mean, that's overthrowing governments and the
right.
World. This World War
right.
II. That's a lot. But is that really justice? Is that really truth, reason, and justice? Might not be. But my point is, people never get to thinking about that because it's done in the name of democracy and expanding freedom and liberty. So yeah. What's wrong with it? You have to do these things. So the mind is fixed on the abstract universal, which holds all the truth and reason that there is. And since it's self-evident, can't be wrong. Can't be wrong if it's self-evident to all men. And if you don't agree with it, there's something wrong with you. Mm-hmm. But that makes sense if there is really a univocal meaning built into the abstraction. But there's not. There isn't one. That's what abstraction means. Abstraction means you've taken out all the particularity, all of the tradition-based things. You've taken them out. Mm-hmm. And for what appears to be very good reason. We have to take them out because they're particular. They don't apply to everybody, and we want universal truth for all human beings. And so we have to clean up the abstractions. We have to distill out all the particularisms. So right. They're just persons. They aren't men and women. They're men and women. That's not interesting. What's interesting is that they're persons.
Individuals.
Yeah. They're individuals. They're individuals, individual persons. And there's a sense in which that's true. There's a sense in which men and women are the same as persons. And the law treats them in certain respects as the same as persons, but not in all respects. You might imagine that. So people like Godwin, for example, William Godwin, who was associated, was married more or less to Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein. What?
I said, oh, yes, I know who that is.
Yeah. Yeah. And William Godwin said that I have no obligations to my children that are different from the obligations I have to other children throughout the world. In other words, it's arbitrary, morally arbitrary for me to privilege my children over other children because we're all equal. Okay, there goes the family. There goes aunts, uncles, grandfathers, grandmothers, sisters, brothers. All those complex relationships are gone because we're all equal. So equality is a very demonic term. It's a term of lie. It pretends to be something it's not. Principle of equality pretends to be something it's not. And it seduces, for example, Americans who are Christians, they're seduced into ideologies which are leading them in a wrong direction because they believe all men are created equal in the image of God. And so they link up with people who say all men are created equal, but they leave out the image of God part. And when they do that, there's a whole moral world that vanishes. And then the Christians are on board with this other thing, which might be liberalism or Marxism or feminism or wokeism. How can they avoid not being part of that? Because they're saying the same thing. We really agree deep down that all men are created equal in the sense that they were created in the image of God. But that, so you have this enormous confusion. Does not every political leader in the world talk about human rights? The Chinese communists talk about human rights? Are they not devoted to human rights? Are not the people in Afghanistan, are not the people in Islamic countries devoted to human rights? America, we're all devoted to human rights. There's the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. And yet, why don't we agree? If the ideas are that important, why don't we agree on policy? What's the problem? We should be able to sit down, like the Enlightenment said, and calculate what should be done for our mutual interests.
Right.
That never happens. So now this comes to your question. What do you do when you face another tradition? If there is a truth about justice and freedom and humanity, if there's a truth, and Christians believe there is a truth, and Muslims believe there's a truth, and atheists believe there's a truth. If there is a truth, how do we argue? How can we reason with each other to affect a change?
Right. Yeah, how are we not just trapped into our particularities?
We're trapped into our, yeah, that's right. It looks like we're trapped into our particularities. And since reason told us that there's more to human beings than just particularity, we stepped out of tradition to be universal and neutral and pure. But then that left us in a no man's land. And we had to believe in news from nowhere. So what do we do? Well, I think Alistair MacIntyre, in a book called Whose Justice, Which Rationality, notice the title, whose justice, particularism, whose, which rationality, which tradition. Each tradition has its own rationality. If it's philosophic, and not all traditions are philosophic, a tradition that's philosophic is one that has institutions within it to try to step outside of all tradition and think. There's nothing wrong with doing that. We do try to step outside of tradition and think in a universal way. The question is, whatever we come up with, we have to bring it back in. And when we do that, we have to engage in a different kind of reasoning, namely one based on tradition. Let me give an example of how science is one of the most tradition-based forms of rationality that we know of. And yet that shocks people because we don't think science is based on tradition. We talk about scientific miracles. They're just scientific miracles, scientific revolution. It looks like scientists are Marxists. They're just revolutionary. They're like wokeism. They just step outside and just destroy everything they inherited and go on and give us truth. No, it doesn't work that way at all. Let's take an example. Let's take what is called the Copernican Revolution. You remember Copernicus?
Yes.
And Copernicus discovered that the planets go around the sun, whereas before, going back to the Ptolemaic astronomers in ancient Greece, right on up to the 15th century or so, it was assumed that the planets go around the Earth. And that is, this looks empirically true. If you look at the east in the morning, the sun will come up, it'll go around. If you turn around, it'll set in the west. And if you wait, it'll come right back up at the same place that it came up yesterday. So nothing is more obvious, nothing is more self-evident, even to the senses, except for one little episode where you don't see what's happening. Nothing is more evident than that the planets go around the sun. And this is true of the stars, they move. So the Ptolemaic astronomers assumed that there were these globes around the sun, larger spheres. And the stars were attached to the spheres. And the planets were attached to the spheres. And some stars move fast, those near the sun, you know, the globe would turn and make a revolution, whereas one next to it would take a long time to make a revolution. This made sense. So you can trace the distance and all of the stars through these spheres. They even made music because they were divine. Kepler talked of the music of the spheres, and there were scientists who worked out the music mathematically. So it could be played. It was heavenly music. And one poem said that when God decides to judge the world and Christ returns, there'll be a trumpet that will unsound the spheres. All the music will be changed. Well, that was science. And that was a rational, you can laugh at that, but it was a rational science. Why was it rational? Because they could predict comets, they could predict where the stars would be, they could predict where the planets would be. And that is not what you want to do? Be able to know how things move? Get control of your understanding? This was a perfectly good science. But it ran into problems, and when they ran into problems, they created a new sphere. But it turned out that if you really started examining things, some of these spheres would have to be wobbly shaped. Because things weren't moving in perfect divine circles, but the heavens are divine, so they wouldn't move in anything but perfect circles. That was a prejudice inherited from the tradition. So this prejudice inherited from the tradition got them off on a wrong foot. But that wrong foot produced results. The spheres did enable them to predict the distance planets were from the Earth, and so on. looking back, we can see that it was all hot air.
Mm-hmm.
But it was rational. So you see that it was rational.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So here's Copernicus, who created the Copernican Revolution. That looks like Copernicus came and said, "This is baloney. This is all baloney. I think it's just the other way. I think the Earth is going around the sun." Okay, we'll prove it. Okay, so he starts looking around. First of all, that's not what he thought. What he saw was their incoherences, and he could not resolve them with these spheres. So a Ptolemaic astronomer was taught, when you run into incoherence and you hit your head against the wall forever, you might step back and rethink some things. That was what they did in Copernican science. And they would do that by creating another sphere and explaining the problem away.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he got to the point where he's toyed with the notion, well, you know, maybe it's just the other way around, and started looking at things from that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at it from that point of view, the same observations begin to take on a different meaning. And one thing leads to another, and you begin to get a crude notion. This might be true. Well, this inspires further inquiry. Eventually, it was sorted out enough so he could publish it, and people began to be shocked about it and all the rest of it. But for many people, they could see there was something to it. And as they worked on it, it got clearer and clearer. And finally, it was pretty well accepted by the scientific community by the 17th century. Now, was Copernicus a revolutionary? No, he was a conservative. That's not a good term because it has, but I mean, I understand. Let's put it this way. He was a loyal and critical participant of the Ptolemaic tradition. He was loyal to that tradition. He was not going to give it up unless he had to. That's all he had.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't do science without that tradition. Nobody could do astronomy without the Ptolemaic tradition. It was the most advanced system in the world. He was loyal to it, but he was also critical. All scientists have to be critical, even Ptolemaic scientists. They could see there were incoherences, so they plugged in another sphere and explained how it worked. No, he was a tradition-bound scientist who would relinquish what he had inherited and what had worked out in experience only if he had to. Well, it got to the point where he had to, or at least thought he had to, so he tried some things. Anyway, so my point is that he was not a revolutionary. Humdrum, Ptolemaic astronomer who kept butting his head against the wall and did what astronomers do. They stepped back and tried to rethink some things. Another one is, Newtonian physics. It was established. People believed there would never be anything beyond. Even David Hume said, I think we've got the laws of the universe settled. There'll probably be no new discoveries. And this was from a skeptic. But then quantum mechanics, scientists began to see some weird stuff that the Newtonian mechanics couldn't explain. They fiddled with it, fiddled, and out came quantum theory. That the universe at the subatomic level just does not behave the same way it does at the macro level. You'd think it would, but it doesn't. They were not revolutionaries. They were all Newtonians. Einstein was a loyal and critical Newtonian. He didn't believe in quantum mechanics. He said it was spooky action in the distance. They didn't believe in the Big Bang. Couldn't believe in the Big Bang because it was assumed from the Greek tradition that matter is neither created nor destroyed. It doesn't have a beginning. It's just always there. Hmm. If it's destroyed here, that just means there's a transfer someplace else. You start a fire, the paper's gone, but the energy's someplace else. So now we've come to quantum mechanics. Loyal Newtonians had worked that out. It wasn't worked out by quantum theorists because there weren't any. They're only Newtonians. It's all that existed. They stumble through problems. Now, the same is true of morality. You have something like slavery in the United States. What are you going to do with it? What you need to deal with slavery in the United States are loyal and critical participants in the political tradition that Americans have inherited. That's all they've got through which to reason. They don't have anything other than that. And that includes British tradition of the rule of law. It includes medieval tradition of natural law. It includes the Christian tradition, not the Muslim tradition or Hindu tradition, the Christian tradition. And if you want to deal with slavery, you've got to take all that stuff, which is not always coherently connected, which you've inherited, that's all you've got, and work through it like a loyal and critical Ptolemaic or Newtonian physicist, and come up with a solution that you can apply to those actual people in the world, in America, slave and free. If you don't do that, if you act like Lincoln, and say that all men are created, America's dedicated to the proposition all men are created equal, and we're going to fight this war to free slaves, with no program to do anything about what to do with them afterwards, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you're going to cause chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be based on lies. It's based on lies and the like. And I can go into that in more detail because that's a sensitive topic. But what I'm trying to show you is whatever the social problem is, if you're thinking rationally, you have to begin with the inherited tradition. If you're not taught your tradition, if you're not taught your history, you won't even know what it is. You have no notion. You won't understand natural law from the Middle Ages. You won't understand British notion of rule of law. You will not understand the Italian Republican tradition or the classical. You will not understand Christianity. And yet those things are America. That's what's constituting America. And you've got to work through that using reason, like all men are created equal, made in the image of God, and stressing that to the public, that God is involved in this notion of equality. We're not talking Hobbes or Marxian equality. We're talking about this sort of equality. And then we can come up with a solution that fits this sort of people, the American people.
Right. So to maybe back off a little bit and just take a break and sort of digest what we've been hearing, it sounds to me like what you're saying is tradition is man's attempt through custom over time to understand his environment, to adapt to it, to live a good life in it. And when new situations arise, new particularities, then the tradition adapts and these situations are worked out. That's the way that normally it works. And so in that scheme, I suppose you have a natural order of some kind. There is a way of life that is given to man that man then seeks to understand and then applied to various circumstances. And this is mediated through the wisdom of the ages, which is essentially what tradition is. Go ahead.
Yes, yes. And so the way I like to put it is reason is embedded in tradition. In other words, there's no reason that's really free of tradition. Otherwise, we get the empty metric system, right? You can't measure anything unless you know what the standard meter is. And that's only in tradition and practice. So the lesson is that reason is embedded in tradition. Okay, if that's the case, then we get back to your question, which we really haven't taken up yet, and that is, you have these billiard balls. There's a billiard ball of Muslim Islam, billiard ball of Hinduism, billiard ball of Enlightenment, each with their own self-defined tradition. And they how do they converse with each other? How can they communicate? How can there be any rational? How can there be a truth that transcends them all? or how can one be better than the other? Let's put it that way. How can one be better than the other? That's all we need to show. If we can show that one can be better than the other, then even though we may not know how to do that in any particular case, if we know that's the case, if we can show that is the case, one can be better than the other, then we at least know there's a possibility of discourse. There's a possibility, and we should try to do that. Let's go with that later. We'll talk about that problem later. You said we were going to take a break.
Oh, right. Well, no, I that was the break. I thought that, I was just trying to cap what you already said and where we've come so far with tradition and ideology.
Well,
so we can go into that now, or we can talk about ideology more. I mean,
let's go into that. That'll finish. Okay. That'll finish up what we need to think about. Okay. The problem then is if you have one conception of rationality and I have another conception and we are thinking philosophically. Now we're talking about traditions that are traditions of rational inquiry. Not all traditions are traditions of rational inquiry. Voodooism, things like that, they have their own kind of rationality, but it's a very weak kind of rationality. You know, the voodoo doctor has power, but there's a point at which if he can't really deliver with the goods, they just kill him. He's gone, and they go to something else. They'll go to another voodoo doctor or something. It's a kind of chaotic thing. So, but some civilizations develop institutions of rational inquiry. The Chinese have, the Indian, India has, Israel, the Bible's an example of that. So, and these books, you know, the Quran and all these books are manuals of how to think rationally about God and man, or the divine and man, let's say, divine. Because we say God, we mean a person. And only Christianity thinks God's a person. Much less that God can dwell in people. It's the only religion that thinks God can dwell in people because it has the Trinity. The Holy Spirit dwells in person's life. So, let's just talk about the divine, the human and the divine, this thing that's beyond the particulars. Mm-hmm. Hinduism has it, Buddhism and so on. Okay, if we have incompatible rationalities, I can give a rational argument to you, but you're not going to buy it because you're presuming. So our conflict is not logical. In other words, we don't have contraries. If you have contraries, both could be false, but only one could be true. Good thing about contraries is one is true. Or it could be true, and both could be false. But what we have with different rationality is incommensurability. Incommensurability means we're using different criteria of what counts as rationality, what counts as justice, and what counts as political reality. What counts as political reality. So Lincoln said that no state, American state, had ever been a sovereign political society, and the Constitution was not a compact between those societies, and that secession was treason and anarchy, literally treason and anarchy. And if that's true, then the full force of government could be used to crush that, because anarchy is the worst evil for political life. You can't have it. Mm-hmm. So you can kill as many people as you need to kill in order to suppress treason, especially half a country, a third of the country becomes treasonous. But he was using a Hobbesian conception of rationality, which I won't go into. The Confederates, which were just the Jeffersonians, they happened to be Southerners, but there were Jeffersonians in the North that thought the same way. They believed that the states began as sovereign political societies before the Union, and they formed a compact. And that compact gave the central government limited powers and preserved all the powers the states had when they were out of the Union. All those powers were still there, except the ones they delegated and the ones that were prohibited to them by the Constitution. Now, those two views of rationality are incommensurable. They're incommensurable. They can't communicate. because what the Jeffersonians mean by justice is incommensurable with what Lincoln meant. For the Jeffersonians, secession is the is part of what Americans meant by political liberty. In the European Union, there was a thing called Britain, and Britain seceded. And the European, even the European Union knew that that secession was what the British understood to be political liberty. The Hungarians and all the other British states know they could secede. They knew that because they all understood that was what was meant by political liberty. But if Lincoln was right, that the states were never political societies, they were just an aggregate of individuals shaped by national authority. If that was true, then the secession would be anarchy. So here we've got two incommensurable notions of rationality. All right, let's switch now to religion. Islam is rash, has its own rationality. Christianity has its own rationality, theological rationality. And yet Muslims convert to Christianity. And Christians convert to Islam. Atheists convert to Christianity. And Christians convert to atheism. It happens. This just happens. So although these rationalities are incommensurable, even though different criteria are used for justice, humanity, liberty, freedom, and all the rest of it, even though that's the case, and it looks like those are hard-nosed things, they're actually fungible. They're quite fungible. These philosophical absolutes are fungible. And a whole way of life, a whole Christian way of life, can be turned upside down and devolve into atheism. A whole Islamic way of life, or as Jesus said, you can be born again as a new person. You can become a new person. In other words, your whole way of, your metaphysical way of life is upset. This happens. It's called conversion, religious conversion. And it happens philosophically, too. The communists of East Germany were communists. They acted like communists. Those of West Germany were more or less liberal. When the Soviet Union collapsed, those East Germans became liberals of sorts. But prior to that, they had been Nazis. They were taken over by communists. The Nazis became communists. My point is, ideologies and even religious views of the whole of reality are fungible for human beings. They make absolute claims, but they're fungible. And that fungibility enables discourse to occur. So how is it that people convert from Christianity to Islam and vice versa? I think it's because of practices. People, it's not arguments. Remember, the arguments are incommensurable. They're never gonna go anywhere. They're enlightening and they can help some people. But I think people are converted in religion and in philosophies by things they see in the practice and ways of life of the people. So remember, Christianity was first, it was not first called Christianity, it was called the Way. There was a Jewish people who believed the Messiah had come, and they were instructed to live out a way of life that was so different, even from the Hebrew way of life. They were not simply supposed to not commit adultery. They were not supposed to think about it. And that's difficult to do. So they had to go through a regimen so that the thought just never occurred to them. And if that happened, then they would be sanctified. They would be moving on the way they should be. So, but people in the Roman Empire saw these Christians doing things like building hospitals, taking the children that had been thrown in on the island in the Tiber River to perish in a little bowl of pots. They didn't want the children. They would just put them there and let them cry until they died. The Christians would go take them and save them. And people saw this. And it touched the heart. it touched something in them that had not been cultivated. They had a tradition that had closed all this off. It was a bloody tradition. I mean, they crucified people, you know, miles of people crucified. You messed around with the Romans, and yeah. That's what you got. So they were hardened. They were hardened people, but they were human beings, and there were parts of the heart that could respond. And I think conversation between philosophies and conversations between religions are pointless if you're operating on the abstract level. You can communicate only with those people who are open to it. In other words, if they have eyes to see, they can see it. If they have ears to hear, they can. But if they don't, they can no more understand than a pathologist can understand sympathy.
Well, there's two things I wanted to, if I could interject real sure. quick, maybe comment and question about. So in the Christian tradition, of course, according to the scriptures, you mentioned John 3 earlier, there is this idea that it does take a miracle to actually truly become a convert to Christianity.
Yeah.
You can be raised in the tradition, but you need the Holy Spirit illuminating your life, coming into your...
Yeah. No one can say Christ is Lord except through the Holy Spirit.
Right. So there is this this element that obviously supersedes rationality, and you cannot get there without that element. Rationality alone won't do it. But at the same time, you do see early Christian apologists, Stephen being one, who was the first martyr of the Christian church,
sure.
trying to argue with, at that time, the Jewish people and say, look, since Christianity was coming out of Judaism, saying your tradition actually supports what we are saying. And then making converts based on that. And I think in maybe a system like Islam, I know I've seen apologists even in modern times say things like, hey, the Islamic religion says that the scriptures are true, but yet you deny the scriptures on these points. You think it's corrupted, or you have to come up with some way of some mechanism of rescuing that yes. teaching of Islam. And so they point out the discrepancy and say, this is what our scriptures teach about who Jesus of Nazareth was. You contradict that in your scriptures. They can't both be true. And if that's the case, then your Islamic scriptures, the Quran, cannot be true. And so they try to point out these contradictions. It seems like that's a worthwhile endeavor.
It is. No, I don't mean to deny that whatsoever. I was running through too many things at once. But that works if you... That works if the person has a heart open to inquiry.
Right.
Einstein was hard-nosed about quantum mechanics, calling it spooky action at a distance, and others had a hard time with the Big Bang. But they were enough scientists that they were open to evidence, but you had to really push it. Some people aren't open, and you can't. You can't expect to make any progress with those. You don't know who they are. Remember Elijah's task in the Old Testament? God told him to go prophesy. He said, well, it's not going to do any good because, they're all worshiping Baal. And he said, no, wait a minute. I can't remember. Right. I think it was 10,000 people or maybe, I don't know how many thousand people in Israel were there who would listen.
Right.
A certain number. He said, you don't know who they are, but your task is to go... give the message, and those with ears will hear.
I think it was 7,000 who wouldn't bow the knee.
7,000. Yeah. Okay. Right. Okay. Right. So it is possible through argument, especially in a culture that's cultivated rational inquiry. Islam has cultivated rational inquiry. They've made achievements in mathematics and all sorts of things. So they are rational. They have that. Some of the more pagan religions are kind of wild. You know, they don't have much of a traditional rational inquiry, but they can be impressed by medicine and things like that and acts of charity. They understand, everybody understands acts of charity.
There is a universe that, oh, go ahead, what? Sorry.
No, you go ahead.
No, I was going to say that there is a universal, you just said everyone is impressed by an act of charity. So there is a universal truth or a universal commonality that people share.
Yeah. Well, I said everyone. Sociopaths are not.
Right.
Right. That's why they're most weird.
Most everyone. There are people that you can't get across to for whatever reason, and that's just the way it is. So we shouldn't try to find an algorithm that can break through everything to communicate, because remember, the inquiries that I'm talking about are incommensurable. Right. Incommensurable. The presumption is they cannot communicate. They cannot.
Mm-hmm.
Because these philosophical presuppositions that they've come to are incommensurable. And
so I'm thinking of Jesus when he says, hey, even unbelievers, they take care of their families. It's essentially a wicked father will give his son a fish. That, yeah. Hey, Christians, you should take care of your kids. God will take care of you. And even we see this even in people who aren't Christians. They do the same thing. There is this,
yes,
this sense in which we are all made because God has fashioned us all and given us certain notions, common notions. There are some things, I'm not saying everything, but there are some things it seems like we do share in common with each other.
Yes. Yes, we do. And if sociopaths don't fall into that category, if they're so hardened that they can't be touched, they have to be left to God. We do the best we can. We don't know who they are. You don't know who the sociopaths are. So
is it fair if we brought it into a modern context for just applicational purposes for the people listening? Is it fair to say, based on what you've been saying for the last hour, rationale or I should say, ideology takes reason and gives it a big R. I say big R reason versus small R reason, but it gives it puts reason in the place of God, essentially.
Yeah,
and then man's reason is able to distill the universal truths that run roughshod over natural organic particularities and communities, cause all kinds of harm. They don't take into account the particulars. And so localized communities in the political world are just, they're run over. They had a thriving community where you could walk into the mom and pop shop. You knew the people there. It was healthy. And now there's the Walmart. Now there's the Amazon.com. Now they're, you know, it's just destroyed something beautiful that used to exist. And that is, that's something that a traditional person like ourselves would mourn. We would say that there are different particular ways that are suited to particular environments and contexts that should be preserved, that are healthy. And so this is the problem with whether we're talking about sort of a revived neo-Nazi kind of ideology that reduces all biological impulses to racial self-preservation, or whether we're talking about some kind of an egalitarian instinct, which we've already talked about, or liberalism. All of these things try to find the universal and they destroy the particular. And that's why people should care about this, perhaps, is that that is a threat.
Yes.
Do you want to expand on any of that?
Yeah, one way to look at that is you said they replace God. I think that's right. And one way to see that is what they do. The ideologue will take some disorder in society that everybody feels, like the Industrial Revolution. That was a pretty rough thing. There was a market economy is fine. You've always had market economies, tribal people trade with other tribal people, and so on. That's not new. It's happened all over the world. But liberalism, marketism, is a different thing. There the state comes in and rigs the market, and so on. So the Industrial Revolution was a bad thing, it was a rough thing. There were many problems with it. And Marx seized on class distinctions. There's the rich and the poor, and the Industrial Revolution is very productive. He loved the Industrial Revolution, very productive. There have never been anything like it. and the machines were building things. You didn't need slaves. So some people getting richer and richer, and the workers were just living on the subsistence level because the free market was in play, and it was abused. So he took that sort of thing. You could see the hungry people in London, the children that were like animals, lost, taking care of themselves on the streets as best they could. All that touched the hearts of people, some people. So Marx tapped into that. And so what he said is that all history is a story of class struggle. So he took this particular wrong in Britain about class struggle and mapped that onto the whole of reality, And that's usurped God. The whole of human history was simply class struggle. He had the key to the whole thing. In Egypt, ancient Egypt, Israel, Rome, Greece, China, and so on. It was all class struggle. Philosophy was just the ruling class justifying itself. Morality was the ruling class justifying itself. So he had this all worked out, a seamless whole. Remember, Lady Philosophy's gown is a seamless gown. You can't unravel it. And that's how ideologies start. Feminists took the difficulties women had in certain societies and spiritualized that into the whole of history. All of history is the story of patriarchal society oppressing women. That's mm-hmm. the meaning of it. Or America is a racist, sexist, homophobic society as a whole. It is a seamless web of racism, classism, sexism, and homophobia. Oh, and transgenderism. Shouldn't leave that out. So, so you take the part and you make it the whole. Now, this is how philosophical thinking has to work, but this is a berserk form of it. For example, if you look at the history of philosophy, philosophy is an attempt to understand reality as it is in itself. And we're not going to listen to the priests. We're not going to listen to founding fathers. We're not going to listen to tradition. We're going to step outside all of that and use our own reason, our own autonomous reason, so the philosopher can see for himself what is ultimately true. This is what philosophy is. When you do philosophy, then, what you're likely to do is tap onto some part of experience that is particularly intelligible to you, and then use that to spiritualize the whole of reality into it. So men in the 18th century were very much attracted to machines, clockwork. And they concluded that the whole of reality is a machine, and maybe a machine maker behind it. He wound it up and he lets it run, and that's reality. And so there's a famous book by a French writer called L'Homme Machine, Man and Machine. The heart's a machine, the kidneys are machines, they pump and send things out and so on. But then Hegel came along and said, no, wait a minute, machines are all very well, but what's really interesting is mice. They look like machines, but then they reproduce. They just reproduce themselves. Machines don't do that. And so you have lots and lots of mice. Now, how does that happen? You can't explain that by machines. So what does Hegel do? Well, the whole of reality is an organism. You see? Plato, the whole of reality is form and content. So philosophers always have to do this. Now, there's nothing wrong with this as long as you don't take it too seriously. In other words, why not try to see the world as the mechanistic characteristic or organic characteristic of society? But don't think it's the whole of reality. That makes you God. And if it is the whole of reality, then political institutions can be shaped with the power needed to enforce that on everybody. Because it's true, or thought to be true. So what the ideologue does, he takes the part and turns it into the whole. All of them do this. And they seduce people because people can see there is class injustice. There is patriarchal injustice. They can see that. And then they support and vote for these people. And then, but they've got a different agenda. They've got a wholly different agenda because they're defining what all these terms mean. And you're starting with your common variety understanding of justice. and tapping into it, and they mean something quite different.
Yeah, and so it takes advantage of the good name that love and justice and truth and even equality.
Christians are dragged into a lot of that foolishness.
Yeah, I've noticed that with the immigration debate.
Yeah.
They'll say we need equality, or they'll say that the Imago Dei means letting people across the border who are not citizens and giving them all the benefits that citizenship has in the United States. And I mean, Imago Dei doesn't teach this, but of course, they've been corrupted through ideology to suit the religion to the ideology and reconcile the two somehow.
Yeah.
Or try to. But I think one of the concerns that I've had is that it seems, and this is maybe my last question for you, and then you can take it wherever you want. It seems like we are coming to a point where people are very deracinated. And I've tried to do everything I can to encourage even younger people who have broken homes and they've moved around and they don't know much about their own past. They don't have a people, they don't have a past, they don't have a place. And this, of course, leaves them in a situation where I think it gives instability and insecurity, and all kinds of bad things come from this. But you want a place of belonging. You want, you're seeking some stability in your life. And so you latch onto an ideology because it promises these things, even though it can't deliver them. It gives you a brotherhood, maybe through chat groups online, people who agree with you that the real issue is it's A, B, or C. And you can switch them out. I know people who have gone from woke or libertarian to social justice to now sort of a modern revived Nazi-esque bioreductionist kind of idea where every problem relates back to Jewish people and their involvement in things. And there just seems to be a desire for that finds these universal simplistic solutions very appealing. And I had someone who is fairly important, I would say, in the Christian right movement recently just asked the question, well, if we are in this spot, if we don't have a tradition anymore, is ideology the only thing left? And if it's ideology, then ought we to be the ones to try to offer our vision of a future that's maybe simplistic and semi-utopian rather than the other guy who's selling his utopian scheme? And so that's what I want to ask you is, have we come to the place where it's inevitable that in American politics, it's just competing ideologies?
To say that we don't have tradition, I don't know what that would mean. I think if you're born anywhere, you have inherited a lot of tradition that you don't even know. Because remember, tradition are inherited practice is a set of inherited practices. If these people who are deracinated know how to do science, they've inherited the practices of rational analysis in that way. You can communicate them in that way. Everybody's inherited moral tradition if they're in a society at all. So I think you always have tradition. I don't know what it would be like not to have it. And so again, ideologies can be shown to be inadequate. You can show you can give arguments that what you've taken the part to be the whole is in Marxism, all is class struggle, or feminism, all is patriarchal oppression. Or all is racist society. You've taken a part to be the whole. It's just not true. There's all sorts of oppression based on race and sex and all sorts of wonderful things that flow from racial distinctions and so on. So there's always that conversation that can go on. And those who have open hearts to inquire, even though they may be stifled with prejudices of the ideological sort, nevertheless are open and there can be a glimpse of understanding. I mean, the pagans were pretty far gone, but Christians were able to get through to them through their practices, their way of life, their martyrdom, their charity. I mean, this blew people's minds. What? Taking these babies that nobody wants and why are you doing that? I mean, what's the point of that? they die, you know, people die. That was something new, and it touched the heart. I think it's the heart's the key. You have to appeal to the human heart. And no matter how clouded it is with disorder, it's still there. And some hearts are more open than others. And some hearts may take 20 years to open, but they can open in 20 years with the gradual seeping in of a distinct way of life. So I think it's a way of life. And so the answer is that you need a way of life to counter these other ways of life. And the church is supposed to be, for Christians, the church is a way of life, the kingdom of God, what was called the way to live, displayed by practice.
What do you say to young Southerners? Because I know you're the founder of the Abbeville Institute, who come to you, and they don't have a sense of Jefferson anymore. They don't understand their own history because they've been taught something different. And maybe they're just starting to awaken to what has been left behind. I mean, they obviously have a tradition. They have an inherited practice, but is it fragmented? How do you describe that situation?
It is fragmented. And but a human being is very complex. I've seen people who know nothing about the Southern tradition. And it's Jeffersonian origins, because the Southern tradition is just the Jeffersonian tradition localized in that place, and it's American. And when they read the documents and about that from that tradition, they are touched by it. I remember one student from New Jersey or something. I read it, gave him Bledsoe's book on David, Is Davis a Traitor? And he read it and came back and said, "Who is this guy?" He said, "I never knew this." He was blown away. Well, he's an American. He's got the American tradition, however garbled it might be. And he may think that the South is irredeemably wicked or so-and-so. But when he read that book, he saw things that he had never seen before. Then he had to fit them in with what he already knew. And this posed a problem. And if his heart is open, he'll try to work that through. He may end up staying where he was before, but now he'll understand his own view better. Or he may begin to realize that he's got to change. That's not helping much, but see, it's a messy thing. Human beings are messy creatures. I think they always come with an inherited tradition. You take them where they are. And the Christians took the pagans where they were. And they pointed out things even in their tradition that they had to acknowledge. And they did a wonderful job of apologetics. And think of the uphill task they had. The pagans had no problem believing Jesus was a god. That was not a problem. The problem was he was a human being and God. That blew their mind. And the resurrection. They didn't believe in a resurrection. The resurrection, you don't want a body for the Greeks. And the Romans, the spirit was the thing. For the most part, the spirit was the thing. And Procrius said, "I'm embarrassed to have a body. I'm just embarrassed that I have this body. And don't talk to me about resurrection. I do not want another one." So they had to penetrate that. Today, people have trouble thinking Jesus was God, but they didn't have that problem. They probably he was resurrected. So, but people are able to get through.
Yeah, every age has its own sets of threats and challenges. But I think that's a good place to maybe end the podcast, because in the Christian conception, there God is working through a means, and the means is men and women who are his followers to then bring his message to the world. And he has a promise attached to that he will bring fruit through those efforts. He will bless them and will bring his will to pass. So
may I just make one little small thing before we go that we can get from Alistair McIntyre. He points out that two traditions can come to understand the superiority of the one over the other is imagine languages. If you learn English as a first language and Chinese as a first language, as a second first language, you got a second first language.
Okay.
It's good in Chinese, and there are people like that. And
you can appreciate, yeah.
And you, yeah, from the Chinese, as you're thinking of Chinese, you can see defects in the English language. You can see things you can say in Chinese you can't say in English. Things you can say in English you can't say in Chinese. One Chinese told me, he was a student from China when I was in graduate school. He said, in China we tend to do science as poetry, and here you do poetry as science.
Huh.
In other words, we don't think the same. So they had to get their minds around. They had to use a Western language to do science.
Hmm.
Helped them to learn the Western language to do science, and eventually they could change the Chinese to do
science. So interesting.
But my point is, you can see that you're inferior to the things that this language is superior to. If you can do that, you can see that your own language is inadequate by having a second first language. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
English is inadequate in this respect. And a person could see that Chinese, who's a Chinese speaker, is inadequate, doesn't have tenses, the things you can't say. So incommensurable, I mean, different languages can break through if you know both equally well. So if you know Islam backwards and forwards, then you're better prepared to be an apologist. That's obvious. So we can't just say that traditions one can't be better than the other. It could be, but we don't know that outside of inquiry. Like Copernicus did not know. He wasn't revolutionary thinking, God, how can we keep tolerating science for 2,000 years, thinking the planets move around the sun? He was not impatient. He worked through. So we have to, we have to know that Christianity is fallible, and there's some of its inquiry, so is Islam. We have to try to work that out and go with what's solid, but it's possible to communicate.
All right. Well, with that, thank you, Dr. Livingston, for coming on the podcast. If people want to find out more about your work, they can go to abbevilleinstitute.org, and Abbeville Press is one of the menu items there. You can also go to Amazon and get Philosophical Melancholy and Delirium, Hume's Pathology of Philosophy by Dr. Donald Livingston. Anything else you want to say where we can go to find out more or communicate with you?
Well, no, I just, the book I've written are there on the Amazon. You can look at those. I think the one on Hume, Philosophical Melancholy and Delirium, is he was the first to criticize ideology. David Hume was the first, so he'd be a good person to begin with.
Yeah. All right, excellent. Well, God bless, and enjoy the rest of your day.
All right, you too.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.